for in-person oral argument is A210569, Holly Joy Click versus Timothy Richard Click. And it's my understanding that we only have counsel for appellant here today arguing. And therefore, sir, you will have 15 minutes, and we don't anticipate a respondent coming, so that will be your full allotted time. Do you have any questions?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. And just a reminder that the timer is on the central podium, and so to keep an eye on that, and please introduce yourself when speaking and identify who your client is. And with that, we can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Brad Hattie. I am the attorney that represents the appellant petitioner, Holly Joy Click, who is also in the courtroom today. I will find a way to hear from Blake. Those were the words of the Honorable Judge Margaret Daly. And it's our contention that she failed Blake, as well as did the guardian ad litem fail Blake. We are here as an abuse of discretion, and I think all attorneys probably sit back a little bit and chuckle because it's such a high burden, but that's, as a term of art, one of our ways of hoping to open the door to try to get another bite of the apple. It's such a wide and broad field of legal argument. But this case is, in my client's opinion, filled with various abuses of that discretion. So when this case came to the court by petition to modify parenting time, there was an ex parte petition and ultimately granted, showing endangerment of the party's 10-year-old daughter. The issues were significant enough, of course, to grant it and as well have a hearing. That hearing, which was conducted in 2020, October, was the only hearing of three significant hearings where there was a transcript. So, knowing my brief, one of the arguments as abuse is the fact that the court, and obviously I have some responsibility in that, but did not know that the hearings were not being taped. They were not going to produce a transcript. And I never believed, and have never, frankly, ever been in another hearing where there were dispositive and non-dispositive decisions that there wasn't a record.
So, if I may, Mr. Hattie.
Yes.
So where do you point to in the rules of maybe a procedure or anywhere else that district courts in those situations required to have a transcript made? Because it's hard to say it's an abuse of discretion if we don't say, but where does it say you had to?
It does not. And that is also something I would say after my career, I would argue to the legislature we need a change. But you're correct. It does not say that it's required. And had I noticed that there would be no record, I would have argued I don't wish to proceed unless there's going to be a record. So that part I accept the responsibility for. And I also accept the responsibility in knowing too late that I had an opportunity to provide my impression of a record. And certainly could be challenged by the court, but I I understand it's 14 days to turn that around. That's my feeling. I don't believe, however, that in light of my request to file a motion for reconsideration that was in my letter denied, that anything would have substantially changed from the court's earlier findings.
So if I can jump in and kind of change, shift gears a bit. I am a little concerned about standing to make this appeal. So as I look at this emergency request from October of 2020, essentially that is in place. There are suspensions, there are changes, there are conditions up until the order that comes through in March. And so I think you're appealing the March order that rolls back the changes that were temporary. Given that this was a temporary motion and that it's essentially 6 months where the motion had been granted, I'm concerned about standing here. What is the grievance? That it wasn't 6.5 months long, that it wasn't 7 months, 8 months, 12 months, when the motion itself didn't confine a period of time? What would be, you're basically saying that the relief on your temporary motion was too temporary.
I believe the argument is that the relief granted was insufficient and therefore not supported by what we believe would have been the facts had two things occurred. Well, three, actually. One, we would have been allowed to have an evidentiary hearing to question.
Oh, no question I understand the issue about the evidentiary hearing. I'm asking more on the before we get to that point, if the motion, temporary motion was granted, what is the grievance? So is there something that wasn't granted in October that you wished had been? Or is it really just the March order that undoes the temporary changes?
I believe that is correct. The final order changes those temporary orders and sets in place a way to basically undo everything that the mother in protecting her child attempted to do. So that is correct. I believe that is.
But if the motion itself was temporary, then where is that line? Where is too temporary? Is it 6.5 months, 9 months, 12 months? Where is that if the motion doesn't specify we want a change in custody and suspension of parenting time for 3 years? Or what are we to do with trying to find out what that how that standing is met if the motion itself is temporary and was granted?
The change in custody was a request for temporary change. And that was ideally, hopefully, on my client's part, arguing that there needs to be certain conditions put in place so that temporary motion could have lasted indefinitely if the court had put in place conditions upon the respondent to get help, to have a psychological evaluation, to acknowledge the problems in a relationship with his daughter. So I, again accepting blame, should have said, we're bringing a motion to modify custody and left the word temporary out of it. But it's the desire of my client to hopefully create a scenario where the father will accept these things and begin to change so that he can co-parent the daughter. That is maybe another fatal flaw. We don't believe so. We believe that because of those last orders that the temporary order has been discontinued and it needs to be continued. It, I think, is also critically important that we reemphasize that we can't, as we stand here today, say what you don't know because there is no record. You don't know that the child didn't say to the guardian, "Yes, I'm okay with having supervised parenting with my father," What she said was, and what we would have brought a witness to, was as long as there are two men there with guns to protect her.
Well, isn't that an option? You could have filed a written submission that says just that, right?
We in our argument that day, which, again, I felt there would have been a record, stated that that's what she said.
Right, but I'm saying you can submit, as you did, two different affidavits. You could have submitted another affidavit from whoever that person that overheard the child say that, essentially putting that before. Really, the difference in not having an evidentiary hearing isn't that you don't get to put forward what you think the child's stated preferences are. The real difference is that you didn't get to cross-examine the guardian, right? So it's that cross-examination piece that's missing from making decisions based on written submissions and making decisions based on evidentiary hearing, unless there's something else I'm not seeing.
Well, there are other witnesses bringing other information. I suppose you could argue.
This can also be affidavits, right? I mean, I've seen that in many cases where you have more than just the parents' affidavit.
No question, and I agree with that, Your Honor. I don't believe, in light of how this trended, that those affidavits would have carried any more weight than my oral argument during the hearings, that these are significantly flawed. I also draw your attention again, I know you've read it, we have a reunification with the father that, if start to finish, would take less than a month to have him fully back with the child without any restrictions, and I find that not acceptable. We don't know the truth. No one is going to come here and say that I'm a legal scholar. I'm passionate, and all of my clients have high-stress cases with children. All I want, all anyone has a right to, is finding the truth. And in no place in these hearings has there been an emphasis on the truth for this child. We have psychologists, all professionals that have said to us, this child suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder with dissociation by the father. Now, you do not, I'm not a psychologist, but you do not put that child back in the home of the father, which are the triggers for that post-traumatic stress disorder. Yet the guardian said, yeah, stage two, we're going to let the father have supervised parenting time in his home. All of this defies, to my client, certainly to me, logic. I urge the court that we must remand back for that evidentiary hearing. We must be able to bring professionals who will be able to say that she suffers from this, that her father is the cause of this suffering, that the court, as you've seen in my brief, ignored the arguments of the petitioner. Although eloquently writing the findings of fact, those findings are not sufficient and can't be argued because of the lack of the record, as well as not having an evidentiary hearing. And we believe and certainly hope that if those were the cases, we had that, and this child was heard. And we know the law in Minnesota. If she's determined to be competent, she can be heard. Judge Daly, to her credit, acknowledged that, at least in Hennepin County, but I will tell you, as a practicing attorney in virtually every county, I would call it a conspiracy, but judges will not listen and don't want to listen to children. Of course, they want to pass that off onto someone else, and who wouldn't? Nobody wants to be involved in these, but this is a very eloquent young woman who compelled the police to believe her, so they called Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services opened up a case and determined that there was wrongdoing by the father, although not sexual assault, but emotionally abusive. And we've got all of the therapists believe her, yet the guardian wants everyone to believe that she's been coached by the mother. And I chuckle again, because if you knew my client, you would know that my client doesn't use the words that this child used, that the guardian believed was a coaching. Nowhere is there anything to establish that that's the case. The guardian talked to the child on two separate occasions, spoke to the mother a couple of times, the father, but initially submitted a temporary parenting plan and recommendation with only one interview of the child and one conversation with the mother. With no other investigation, no other reading of police reports, nothing else with regard to the things that establish what type of father this is. And then saying to me in an email, I am standing by my recommendations. The father is, I'm not a psychologist, but a narcissist, a misogynist, who's been convicted of more than one domestic assault on women, has more than one DUI, has treated this child like an endangered servant, making her rub the feet of people, and other things. It's in the brief, as you know. I apologize. This child's safety.
Could I interrupt you with one additional question? The crux of your argument, it seems, is there should have been an evidentiary hearing. There should be an evidentiary hearing, and the child should be able to testify. But first is that, should there be an evidentiary hearing? And when I look at the statutes, it appears to me that there's a different evidentiary hearing kind of requirement, or to the extent there's no requirement, for when you make a motion for a temporary change as opposed to a permanent change. I mean, would you agree that the statutes treat them differently?
Yes.
So from that perspective, that's hard for me to figure out why this would be an abuse of discretion, since you admittedly asked for, and your client may have had the best of intentions in doing so, asking for a temporary change. So I know you're past your time, but Judge Wheelock, if I may just ask for a little bit of a response to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. And yes, it's a fair question, and yes, you are correct. My brief points out that the court offered an evidentiary hearing to the respondent, and that's in the first transcript. I, on multiple occasions, including that first hearing, requested at the bench a motion to have an evidentiary hearing. It's discretionary, not required. But in light of what we presented as conflicting information, what we believed were supportive facts, we believe it was an abuse not to grant that evidentiary hearing. No question, the court did not have to because of the labeling, but should have and still should have.
Thank you for your arguments today, counsel.
Thank you very much.
And the court will take this matter under advisement and will issue an opinion.